Good evening and welcome to this week's edition of The Public Eye right here on 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye, and as many of you, many of our loyal listeners know, there are weeks when I feel very comfortable in discussing certain topics, and then there's sometimes when I stretch the boundaries, which I think is good for one's mindset, learn things that you're not so familiar with, and or explore things that are new to you. And that's why this week I came across a new book, The Devil's Castle, Nazi Eugenics, Euthanasia, and How Psychiatry's Troubled History Reverberates Today. And my guest is the author, Suzanne Antonetta. So for the next half hour, I'll be talking with Suzanne, and I know I'm going to learn a few things, and hopefully you'll learn something too. But the book's been pretty interesting and a great read, and I have to admit that it's as much as there may be some discomfort in reaching out to subjects or topics that we may not be familiar with, in the end, you find out that, hey, you know, I'm glad I did that. I'm glad I read that, or I'm glad I spoke to that individual because I've learned something. And it's always good, right, to learn something new. Suzanne, nice to have you with us.
It's wonderful to be here, Al. Thank you for having me.
I kind of rambled on a little bit there on the introduction, but I had to be honest, you know, not only with you, but certainly with the listening audience, that sometimes, you know, topics or subject matter that we don't deal with, and you know this better than anybody, we tend to be creatures of habit. I'm certainly, you know, in fact, I'm hoping the Smithsonian will accept me at some point, because I'm probably the least likely person who likes any kind of a change. Once I get into that comfort zone, it's like, let's stay right here. But let's start right from the beginning. Eugenics. What is eugenics, and why is it so important, and why did it play a big role in your book?
Sure. Well, I'm going to retrofit this a little bit. I think we saw when that American Eagle's Good Genes commercial came out that as much as it is an uncomfortable topic, we all are thinking about eugenics kind of a lot. I think it's one of those things that's been simmering under the surface of our culture and bubbles up quite frequently. It simply is, the term dates back to 1883. A cousin of Charles Darwin's coined that term, a self-educated man named Galton. And eugenics is simply the idea that some genes are superior to others. Some hereditary material, because they didn't really know about the gene back then, is superior to others. And that in order to survive and thrive, cultures need to try to have more reproduction from the good side, and that's in air quotes, and less from the bad side, and that's also in air quotes, because this is all mostly nonsense and pseudoscience.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say. I mean, we have a president who's used the term "good genes" many, many times publicly. So, as much as it's pseudoscience, it's a pseudoscience that's kind of stuck.
I think it's a great idea. I was taught from early on, not only from, you know, close friends and family, but from teachers and just about anybody that a young person comes into contact with, put your best foot forward. Let's develop this better. I see this. I see you have a unique talent for something. So people many times recognize traits within each individual and individuals themselves and want to capitalize on that, because one, it's probably what you do best, or those genes, as you said, those genes that make up who we are. But for some reason, that doesn't always play out. I mean, I can't tell you how many people would say to me, if we were in a small group right now, and you say, you know, have you been happy with your career or the direction you've gone to in life? Well, yes, but I think I could have done this better, or I should have taken this path. So I'm kind of thinking that this plays all into it, that, you know, in people's minds, you know, they want to do the best. They want to utilize, you know, their talents, those innate talents. But what gets in the way, and how does it play a role in psychiatry?
Well, I mean, obviously all of us do inherit certain things, but genes are just much less predictive and much less you know, we're not just born with a blueprint that becomes who we are. Genes sort of offer suggestions in some ways, I would say. And I think that science has really, and we go through this, whenever there's a big scientific discovery, it tends to get exaggerated. And I think the effects of genetics continue to be exaggerated in that many people kind of understand them as very black and white when they're not. And as, you know, hereditary traits, I mean, Germany, one of the things I write about in The Devil's Castle is the German massacre of people with mental diagnoses. They killed hundreds of thousands of people, and the original gas chambers were built to kill psychiatric patients, not Jews. Mm. And that, you know, they started that process in 1939. So, I mean, that is an, you know, really hideous example of taking genes as, you know, kind of these gods, these inalterable traits. And at the time that Germany was doing that, the U.S. was very complicit. We had many eugenic things going on here. We were doing eugenic sterilization beginning in 1907. So I think that the problem with, you know, developing the traits that you have is that we are just so locked into the idea that, well, either I have the genes for this or I don't, or if I have this gene, I'm kind of doomed. And, you know, Nazi Germany was a terrible example of something because they wiped out schizophrenia in the population. They through sterilization and through this eugenics program of euthanasia, and they did not see schizophrenia go down any in the population. So I think going back to people want to develop, you know, their genetic advantages, sure they do, but I think most of us have a very dim sense of what genes are and a very deterministic sense of what genes are, none of which is scientifically accurate.
Yeah, I'm glad you said
that. Genes offer kind of a, you know, a fuzzy blueprint.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I agree with you. I think a lot of people sometimes sit in the sideline going, you know, I've got this issue, but I just, you know, where do I go from here? Not everybody is comfortable reaching out to professional help, and I'm talking about psychiatry or just talking to psychologists, somebody that can, you know, help people understand all of this. But I'm also glad that you used the example. I wasn't sure if you were going to do that in this interview, is to talk about the you know, the horrible things that went on, you know, in Nazi Germany, and as you said, you know, it was really a cleansing. Let's get rid of anybody that has the slightest flaw or can't, you know, live up to a certain standard, and let's create. I think the term was at the time the perfect person or the perfect man. Yeah, and it's even today it you know resonates in a very you know horrifying way. I just want to take a quick pause to remind our listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is Suzanne Paolo Antonetta. Her new book is The Devil's Castle, Nazi Eugenics, Euthanasia, and How Psychiatry's Troubled History Reverberates Today. Again, Suzanne, I'm going to take a piece out of that subtitle, How Psychiatry's Troubled, and I emphasize troubled history, you know, putting aside the Nazi Germany example for the time being. I remember up here in you know Massachusetts, born and raised here, the institute, young people, not just young people, but a predominant amount of young people who had, as you talked about, issues that family members couldn't understand. You know, the medical community didn't really know how to address this, and many of them were just locked away in institutions or put away and forgotten and never to be seen or heard from again. So what I'm getting at is, you know, obviously things have advanced tremendously, thank God. But back then, was that just because there was not enough knowledge about this idea of eugenics, how to approach it, how to treat or you know, analyze this in individuals? So the only answer was, Well, you know what? Your son, your daughter, your grandfather, your grandmother, you know, whoever it may be, your next door neighbor, there's no hope for them. So the best thing is just to put them into a, you know, an institution and let them get some professional help. At least that way they won't hurt themselves. It sounds like an awful, crass, horrible way to address it. But is that kind of where they were at that point?
Well, I think one of the things that's really important to recognize about psychiatry is that it has never been, and maybe never will be, a linear medicine. It has had better periods than the period we're living in now, one of which occurred in France in the late 1700s. And I, by better, I do mean better. I mean better rates of cure. So I would say that, for one thing, thinking of it as there were bad days, now we're in good days, is probably never going to be accurate in this field, because treating the mind takes a lot of resources, and resources tend to be withheld, poured out when there's some hope, there's some ideas that there might be, you know, ways to deal with mental problems, and, you know, then resources get withdrawn when people get pessimistic again. I think we're in a bit of a period of pessimism, and I think we're in a bit of a period of limited resources, which is just borne out by the fact that we have one of the unhappiest populations right now we've ever had in this country, especially the young. There's really a high rate of mental distress among the young, and there are much better ways of doing things than what we're doing now. That's one of the things that I really explore in The Devil's Castle, that there have been many historical periods where mind care was better, because doctors were really putting a lot into the relationship with the patient, into helping them holistically with their lives, which is something that we've kind of abandoned right now, and I think to our peril. And I think that a lot of what we are doing now is based on essentially the assumptions of German medicine in the earlier 20th century, which is that we're dealing with biological brain disease, we're dealing with, you know, neurotransmitters and brain processes, and you have to treat the brain as if it were any other organ, none of which is true and none of which really works. So that's what I would say. I mean, there have been bad periods here where too many people were institutionalized. On the other hand, the 60s and 70s, we had some community mental health care that was actually super successful, and we're not doing it anymore. So I would say there's more of a balance there than perhaps your question suggested, and that we need to be, and it's one of the things I do in my book, I don't just look at this sort of bad period, I look at all the things that have worked. We need to start doing that again. We need to say, you know what, people should not be this unhappy. This should not be the suicide rate. What can we do? What has worked in the past, and what can we do now to make it better? Because there really are a lot of things that we can do better.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the younger generation today, because unlike myself, did not grow up with the social media. It just didn't exist. The cell phones and all the platforms. And I hear this daily, whether it's from friends or cohorts or just people in general, just talking like, "Oh, did you see what happened? Did you see the news report of that? You know, that person committed that horrible crime, but they were influenced." And I'm thinking, yeah. And then pair that to what you said earlier, and the fact is that there were periods, in at least in this country's history, where we were really ratcheting up our the psychiatry end of things, psychological medicine, if you will, therapies that looked very promising.
Yes.
And here we are, the ebb and flow. Now we seem, and I have to agree, especially after reading your book, that there's a big portion of various generations, and as you mentioned, the younger generation especially, who aren't getting the help. There's no outreach. And that's scary. Does that create more problems for not only for the existing generation who are going through this, but what does that say about our future? I mean, are we doomed?
We're not doomed, because we actually have so much great information about Philippe Pinel in France in the late 1700s and his moral treatment. Pinel said things that, I mean, everybody who deals with the mind should be studying people like Pinnell, because he said things like, if you don't, it's much more important to understand the patient and their lives. And that goes back to Hippocrates, than to understand the disease. And he said the real medical skill in using medication is knowing when not to use it. So Pinnell said you can't treat somebody unless you want, and he meant in psychiatric terms, unless you understand their hopes and their dreams. And I think that's absolutely true, and it's been proven true again and again and again. Here in the U.S. and around the late 1960s, I think, 69, I believe, a man named Lauren Mosher started a program called Soteria, where he treated people in early stages of psychosis without medication, but with just very humane, intense one-on-one care, and they did better than people who were hospitalized and medicated.
I love that. What you just said seems to me, I'm thinking, okay, what if I were in that position? Do I want to be heavily medicated? No. Do I want to be sent off to a institution, whether it's short-term, long-term? No. Dialogue, open communications with somebody who's willing to listen and at the same time, be non-judgmental, right? And hopefully... you find some kind of a balance.
Right.
But here's the thing, Suzanne, that sounds so simplistic. Why not grasp it? Why not, is it because of, the way the, and this is not about attacking, insurers, especially healthcare insurers, but is it, does money play into this? Does the insurance industry play into this? Why aren't people able to get more one-on-one?
The insurance industry is playing into it deeply, of course. And when around 1980 we started this move to think of mental distress as not psychological or not even multifactorial, which is what it is, but as biological brain disease. I mean, you can find books like The Broken Brain, which was published in 84. It was written by one of the women who was really one of the architects of how we practice psychiatry now. And she said that, unfortunate life events occur, but really the problem is biological processes in the brain. So we're just putting a lot of eggs into that basket of there's something wrong, it's a physical thing, we can just... And one of the things she wrote in her book was, oh, now the 15-minute appointment will replace the hour-long appointment. In other words, we won't be doing therapy, we're just going to be dispensing medicine. And... arguably it was an experiment worth trying, but it hasn't worked. We have more people in care and more people in distress at the same time. That's a pretty good indicator that the care is not going the way it should. And so we have to look at this, in a multi-pronged way, and that's person first. And that whenever people have done that with psychiatric patients, it's worked. Another figure in my book, the German woman Dorothea Buck, she was sterilized by the Nazis because she was diagnosed with schizophrenia, but she wasn't killed under the Action T4, the euthanasia program, because she was in a hospital with a doctor who refused to cooperate. And she created her own system of mind care she called Trialogue, and it was very successful. And it involved a lot of patients helping other patients. She certainly had psychiatrists involved as well. So they would identify people's triggers. They would come up with sort of ways to stave off getting to the worst place. They would have medical contracts so they could be medicated for X period of time, but no longer, which made them feel much more confident putting themselves in the hands of a doctor. So she did a lot of really smart things. People who heard voices, instead of like immediately throwing meds at them, they would actually sometimes have the person carry around a tape recorder. And when they played it back, of course they realized there were no voices. Because if there were voices talking to them, the tape recorder would pick it up.
Right.
And then they would kind of start a dialogue. Well, you thought you heard voices. They're obviously coming from inside, not outside. What are they telling you? And it worked. I mean, there were hundreds of these seminars, and they were extremely helpful for people. But after her death, they mostly stopped doing them. They still do them in Hamburg. And, you know, just these very smart things, we have access to them, but no one's kind of putting them together, and no one's putting it into the education of our psychiatrists that these things have worked. And, you know, we just need to kind of go back and look at what we're doing.
Yeah, to me, I mean, it sounds very humane. Okay, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the one hour sessions were cut to 15 minutes, and that's certainly not helping a whole lot of people. But yeah, I think by and large, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this is globally. I don't mean, you know, everybody points their finger, you know, at America. You know, that's the problem country. Everybody has people are people. I don't care where you come from. These issues affect everybody globally. But it would seem so elementary, so basic that, you know, as you said, face-to-face, humanistic dialogue, spend a little time getting to know that individual and what it may bring forth, maybe a plethora, if you will, of emotions and what's really at the core of all the feelings that people are going through. As I said, if I had a choice, a 1 hour one-on-one would be the only type of therapy that I think I'd be agreeable to, you know, just writing prescriptions for medications sounds so barbaric, to say the least. But with that said, let me ask you, as I go back to that idea of globally, you know, people look to the United States always and have for centuries that this country leads the way in so many ways. But, you know, after reading your book and listening to you this evening, I get the sense that, you know, we've got a lot to learn as a country, especially when it comes to this type of care, right? Other regions, other countries in the world, maybe because they've been around longer, I don't know. But, it seems like America should be on top, and yet we're not, and we have a long way to go. Is that fair?
It is fair, and there's a wonderful, interesting psychiatrist named Alan Francis who actually, you know, psychiatry, all our diagnosis is based on a document called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. He worked on the fourth revision of the DSM, but really came out publicly and rejected the one we use now, the five, as overreaching, leading to the diagnosis of children. I mean, a lot of things. He had a lot of issues with it. And he said the U.S. is one of the worst places to be mentally ill. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that, but we are falling behind right now. And we can look at, also when we look at models, Northern Italy decided they didn't want people in big mental hospitals, that those were ultimately going to be abusive. And they closed them and replaced them with community clinics. And in places like Trieste, they have jobs for people with what we would call the major disorders. They have community care. People do not live on the streets there. They just don't get as badly off because they feel very comfortable going in to get help. They have jobs. They have lives. It's not necessary for things to be the way they are here, where, and I'm quoting Alan Francis again, our jails are our real psych hospitals. He said arguably the largest psych hospital in this country is the L.A. County Jail. And I've worked in jails as a volunteer for years, and it's absolutely true. The number of people in there who are diagnosed with something and struggling with it, but, you know, trying to survive on the streets and therefore getting arrested, that was typical. So we're not doing well right now. I think that we may be at an inflection point where a lot of people are realizing, hey, what we're doing isn't working. We're losing our young people. I hope people are ready for a change. And like I'm saying, we do have lots of places to look to see how to do things better.
I couldn't agree with you more. And then, you know, it's as I said, if I after reading your book, or while reading the book, you know, I tried to put myself in that position And it requires a little self-reflection too. You know, you have to be honest before you can accept change. Things aren't going the way they are. We do see, I know, right here in New England, you know, beautiful as it is, you know, street corners, you know, you find people homeless living on the streets. Many have disorders, and it's like, why should such a wealthy country as this not be able to provide for these people? And I don't want to sound like you know, like I'm a saint and this is my you know, this is my mission. You know, I'm not able to change that, and I think you probably feel the same way. But by writing a book like The Devil's Castle and really putting it out there in plain simple terms, is that, you know, in spite of what we think, the way we go about treating individuals with these issues is not cutting it. We're not successful at it, and it's time to take a look at that. With that said, and we've got a few moments left, but let me ask you, based on your experience, and you know, certainly after writing the book and the research that you put into The Devil's Castle, are you fairly confident in that there's enough people who are advocating for change? And, you know, and I guess it's one thing people say, hey, Al, you know, we get groups together and they're petitioning government for this, or they're petitioning, you know, this organization for that, and nothing ever comes of it. It's very easy to, I guess, to have that negative thought. But in your mind, in your own words, with the few moments that we have left, let me ask you, because you spelled out, you know, what we probably need to do. Is it likely we'll see that anytime soon?
You know, I actually am optimistic about that. Our DSM, which, as I said, you know, insurance companies require doctors to use it to get reimbursed, was last revised in 2013, so it's due for an overhaul. And maybe I'm a cockeyed optimist, but what I would love to see is a group of people where no one involved is tied to pharmaceutical companies, because for the last revision, quite a large majority of the people in the task forces were getting money from pharmaceutical companies. So we get rid of that and we bring in actual patients, people who experience these things, which is what Dorothea Buck's Trialogue did, and they have an equal voice. I think that we could get somewhere, and I think that given that the DSM needs an overhaul, I'm just really hoping that we're going to get to the point where it's overhauled in a way that completely kind of changes the playing field and brings us to the kind of thing they're doing in Northern Italy, the kinds of things people have done in the past in things like Soteria. So maybe I'm a cockeyed optimist, but I kind of feel as if we may be at a tipping point. At least I really hope so.
I kind of have to agree with you. I mean, I'm not always the eternal optimist or a cockeyed optimist. Sometimes just the opposite. But I do feel that, because I hear it so often from people that, you know, they're shocked, they're in dismay as to, you know, when you hear about heinous acts taking place and how it could have been preventable, or you know, someone lost their life and, you know, because of, you know, mental health issues, and, you know, why wasn't where was the safety net? It's not just, you know, it's not just local anymore. It's not just regional, it's national. That's when I think shame can be affected, is when there's a lot of voices.
And the psychiatrists I know aren't happy. I have a lot of psychiatrist friends. They're not happy with this system either. This isn't what they wanted to do. This isn't what they signed up for.
Right.
You know, 15 minutes and a prescription. So a psychiatrist I know are just getting out of the system and saying, I'm figuring out a way to work without insurance because it's, you know, it's a moral injury.
Right.
To practice that way. So I'm hoping that, you know, the field as well is going to start.
Well,
because we're having a hard time getting med students to even go into this.
I bet.
Specialty.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that the field itself will start doing some introspection as well.
Well, I guess one of the first places to start would be, and this is no joke, is to pick up a copy of The Devil's Castle and read the book. And very eye-opening, very user-friendly. You know, Suzanne did not write this with the intent of, you know, this for only for medical school students. This is a book for everybody at any point in your life, an enlightening book that gives you a good sense of what, you know, what's happening around us, and, you know, and hopefully get people motivated. Suzanne, real quickly, if people want to reach out to you, I know the book is widely available, but if they want to reach out to you directly, is there a website? Is there Facebook? You know, how might they reach that?
Yes, I do Facebook and Instagram. I'm Mad Suzanne on Instagram and just Suzanne Paola Antonetta on Facebook, and also on Threads and Blue Sky. And SuzanneTonetta.com, SuzanneTonetta.com is my website. And you can find lots of stuff there. And I have a contact form. I love to hear from people.
I love that Mad Suzanne.
I know.
Sometimes you have to be mad to make, you know, to get things stirred, you know, to get things moving.
Sure.
So.
Well, mad in all dimensions of the term.
Right, exactly. Again, Suzanne, thank you so much for being my guest this evening. The book, again, is The Devil's Castle, Nazi Eugenics, Euthanasia, and How Psychiatry's Troubled History Reverberates Today. Like I said, a great read and an eye-opening read as well, and something that I think brings clearly to the forefront, you know, what's happening to many people across the nation and across the globe. If you have any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I always certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.